The Corn Berserkers are definitely Corn Berserkers.
Listen up, Umi. This is a podcast with the most Tucker. This is Forge the Narrative.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host. We are the Bell of Lost Souls podcast. I'm joined by Adam Camilleri.
Hello. How's you doing?
Tanya Gates.
Hey, everybody.
And Red Powell is back.
Yay. What up? Glad to be back.
Yeah, I mean, you showed up right at the right time. We're going to be talking Angron today.
It's about time. I appreciate y'all saving it for me. I know you did.
I do feel like this has been peak Red season. Like, we've had the Guard Codex, we've now got World Eaters brewing, and it's nowhere to be seen. What's going on?
I'm sorry. I got busy. Things got to be done, you know, country's got to get saved.
It's not like you do an important job or anything. It's not like you've, like, anything, you know, any important rankings or denominations.
He's obviously your name. Just been working on his Guard Army list. That's important stuff.
Tell you what, I'm so glad. I mean, we've talked about it. I'm so glad I've got the Scions. I did pick up a Shadow Vaults kit, so I've got the Kazurkin and everything, which I'm really excited to play. It's just some really good looking stuff in that codex. But World Eaters.
Yeah, World Eaters still, you know, a lot unknown, but we did get some information on Angron's rules. Look, we can talk about the rules in a vacuum, by the way, because we can talk about what we know about a survivability based on the base stats, and there's all kind of stuff we can discuss. But I want to preface this by saying it is complete within a vacuum. We don't know what else is in the codex. We don't know what else the stuff can do. A lot of variables involved in this game, of course. So just going to be looking at the base stats. And yeah, I mean, they are impressive. 16, movement is 16, weapon skill, ballistic skill 2+, strength 9, toughness 7, 18 wounds, 12 attacks, leadership 10, and a 2+ save.
Can we just wind back for two of those things? Have we seen anyone with more than 10 attacks on their profile? Like, just base attacks. We've seen 10 before, haven't we? But we haven't seen any more than 10 so far this edition. There are plenty of things that can make more than 10 attacks, roll more than 10 dice, but having 10 under the A,
Just 10 on the stat line.
Yeah, this is a first, I think.
You could be right. I'm trying to think if there was any, like, if it has a D6 extra attacks or turn it into 2 attacks or something like that, you would, that's on the weapon profile and not the base stat line.
It's not listed underneath the A on the stat sheet.
Yeah.
On the data sheet. Yeah, it's kind of wild to see them try to finally be like, let's bust this big old red ceiling wide open, you know?
Yeah. Like a leadership 11 for the Custodes.
Yeah, exactly right.
I mean, when things start going above strength 10, right? Like strength 12.
Yeah. I'm super excited to see another Primarch get released, especially one with a model as freaking amazing as this one.
It's so aggressive. And, like, I love everything it's bestial and, like, brutish in all the right, like, proportions.
Am I right in saying, though, that this is almost 6 years between Primarchs, Mortarion being the last one that was released? We had, the first two, then Mortarion, and now we've been almost, well, edition and a half between the last one, yeah?
Mortarion was 2017.
Sheesh, yeah. So, yeah, almost 6 years.
Yeah, and we know that because we talked about the model a year. I think Mortarion was more model of the year in 2017. It's hard to believe it was that long ago.
Almost poignant that they didn't have Angron in the 2022 awards possibilities. So tells you probably not getting him by Christmas.
Dang. Yeah, they did. I think the preview and everything, I think that they've said almost all this is happening in early winter to midterm.
Yeah, I'd be curious because I was looking at the models, thinking about, like, how would I go about painting this? Like, what would I do to make this do it justice for one and not be intimidated by it?
You're right. It is one of those sculpts that you look at it, apart from it being posed exclusively to be intimidating, it is intimidating to look at this amount of detail. Everything about it is aggression, intimidation. It's scary to even conceive, like, how you go about painting it.
Yeah, this hobby segment, which we promised in the last episode, will be about camouflage and stuff on IG, Astra Militarum AM. But I definitely want to talk, about Angron first, because, you know, we got this community page, and it's kind of hard not to want to put Primarchs on the table. So with they did provide us with a handy dandy chart here of the Guardsman O-meter. Yeah, so even with an average set of rolls, you can expect Angron to effortlessly eviscerate around 30 troopers like it's no big deal.
This should be adopted wholesale, by the way. This should, I expect this to be every new character gets their Gardometer. Like, is, yeah, every single one. I want it to be unanimous. But here's the issue, right? There's been a lot of debates. Who do you think has the biggest Gardometer in the 41st millennium right now?
Like an actual character model?
Well, in the mythos, in the lexicon of the game, in the world, and everything in 40K, 30K, all between. Who's taken the most per day?
Per day.
Now you're getting at it. Now you're getting it. It's a leading question.
Per day. Like an average per day?
Yeah.
Commissar.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I think these guys have got some rookie numbers because I'm looking at 36. Old Papa E is putting down 1,000 a day, baby.
They're not.
They
got to
pump up these numbers.
Yeah.
He's just sitting on a chair doing 1,000 a day. Angron's got 30 something. Who cares? No, get out of here.
Angron's rocking like 30 a minute, you know, whatever, 36 a minute. I do think there is a line of text in one of the Siege of Terror novels that Angron is basically killing thousands a day.
Yeah, it was some during the, well, so that was after they broke the, yeah, that's late in the Siege books when things are going to be rampant and Angron's been unleashed. But 100%, he's like smashing, soloing convoys and like troop breakouts, and he's just like, haha, mine.
Where no one is near Angron. Like, Angron has no one around him. no, and only enemy. Everybody's an enemy kind of thing. Yeah.
See, I'd love him to have a rule like anyone within three. Like, do you remember how Mortarion had his like range of decay? Like, if you were within 9 inches, you took on a 4+, you took D3 within X amount of inches. This was last edition. He had like an aura of you just took mortals by existing near him. Angron should do the amount of attacks for the amount of models within XYZ, and he degrades along with his profile. Oh, so within awesome. 9 inches, everyone just gets hit because he's just going absolutely ballistic, like twirling, spinning, whirlwind of insanity. Everyone gets hit. Auto
hit. All you do is you bubble up chaos cultists around Angron, as many as you can fit in the bubble. And that's how many attacks he gets.
If he had, like, we're like in dreamland, by the way. These are not his stats. Yeah. But we were just like, wouldn't it be cool if? But yeah, y'all are onto something. Like, what if it was you just added up? He had like 5+ everyone within 12 inches of him attacks.
Yeah, because he's just going rampaging out that hard that everyone just can't not get hit.
Yeah, if he went near someone who was also like a bad mamma jamma, he would automatically get their number of attacks plus his.
That's cool. That would be cool. Yeah, hits them extra.
Yeah, that's not what we're dealing with here. But it's I think he's good enough on the attack front.
He's definitely good enough.
he's got these rules here: wrathful presence in your command phase. Select one of the following abilities. This model has the ability until the start of your next command phase. While friendly world leader core unit is within 6 of this model, add 1 to the attacks characteristic of the models in that unit. That's pretty cool. While another friendly world leader unit is within 6 of this model, each time a model in that unit makes an attack, reroll the hit rolls of 1 or a righteous slaughter. While a unit is within 6 inches of this model, that unit cannot fall back.
Nice.
Yeah, we look for these combat tricks. And I think what people are going to be talking about now is that, do we know if he has any way of mitigating damage, incoming damage?
Well, that's right, yeah, because he's, what, 18 wounds, he's toughness 7, but he's got a 2+ armor save, which is pretty good.
Yeah, you've got to have an invulnerable save too. I mean,
you got to assume it's a 4+, you know, for a minimum of 4+ invuln. But still, toughness 7, 18 wounds, I don't care what your save is, that's not lasting that long in the current game.
Maybe have some armor of contempt.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's he's 3 multi-melters away from death. This feels a bit rough for a Primarch, so I'm hoping there's more to this story, like he's got half damage, or the closer he gets to you, the less damage he takes, or something like that.
Summon him in or something? I mean, who knows?
Yeah.
Even if he can't mitigate the damage, or if there's other stratagems or something in the book to help World Eaters not take damage or shrug off injury or whatever, maybe some alternate way of deployment or something.
I mean, it just say at the end of the article, for Angron himself, on the other hand, death is not assured. He can and likely will return from death if your army has performed sufficient slaughter using Reborn in Blood.
Ooh.
That's what I was about to say. If anyone should get wounds back from stuff dying on the table, if anyone should get back up after dying because his boys have killed enough of the enemy or enough of them each other, it's Angron. Like, you know, we talk about Zombie Knight, like the Tyrannus house for Imperial Knights. When a knight's dead, you can spend some CP and roll a dice, and then you got a chance to get your knight back. 100%, he should just have that on his. He should be like, when he first time he dies on a 4+, 5+, 3+, 2+, depending on how many like other deaths have happened in that turn or whatever, or phase, Angron comes back. I love the idea of a mechanic like that.
Well, with a, you know, people are going to be figuring out ways to get him on the table. If there's any way to make it happen, then generals will figure it out. And sometimes you just be like, you know, whatever, rule of cool. This guy's got to, I gotta roll with him.
I mean, that's true too. I mean, T-Sun's players, Death Guard players, they've, people still play Magnus and Mortarion and still do quite well.
I've seen Mortarion fairly recently. I haven't seen Magnus in quite some time.
I tend to see Magnus more in team events because he is like the, if you can pair T-Sun's into armies that have psychers as well, he's oppressive. Because he shuts down all their psychic powers, and he also opens up, if they've got psychers, it opens up one of the best psychic secondaries for T-Sons. As in, if they just do more spells than you, they get points. It usually ends up being an auto 15. If like you're playing Space Marines and they've taken a Librarian, they're like, haha, send in the Magnus T-Sons. Because there's no chance that guy casts, and you just get to do whatever you want.
No, there's one side. You basically, the Wrath of Magnus, is that what it's called? Is that the secondary?
Exactly right, yeah. Yep.
That you get if you cast more maledictions, more blessings, more witchfires or whatever.
Spot on.
Yeah. Gotcha. So I guess, yeah, in an event where you can skew your matchups a bit, I guess these characters do become infinitely more valuable.
When it comes to the skew matches and everything, I mean, I'm the guy who took, you know, I made sure that my army when I was running Khorne was divisible by 8 by the number of units. I made sure that I only ran 8-man squads of Red Butchers and Berserkers. And I had 8 built out profusely throughout the whole list. And so in this case, I have no doubt that it's absolutely possible to build in Angron with the team and make it all of that same kind of deal. I really look forward to how the World Eaters Codex is going to build. I'm interested to see how some of the other leaders between Karn or the Lord Invocatus or the you know, Lord on Juggernaut, along with the 8-bound and the Jackals and everything. I'm interested to see how that plays out. We've seen some previews of them here and there, but there's clearly some other aspects that are missing that I have no doubt are going to add to the synergy of the Codex going forward. I mean, I as a lot of these things have been reviewed, I have gone back and I've pulled out the White Dwarf that has, you know, the updated World Eaters for right now, that how they play with the new Codex. But I'm interested to see how what the actual World Eaters Codex is going to do with that and what that ends up looking like.
It's real possible that having a figure like this in the army just buys time for the rest of your units to get into position. I mean, if it is an assault-based army, which we kind of have to assume that it is, that you know, that first turn of just getting across the table is incredibly important. And if you could spend 400 points, 350 points on ensuring that happens every turn or every game, then maybe you do that.
I mean, especially if he's, yeah, maybe you do, like, in the right environments, in the right, like, what we say meta, like the right metas, and especially in other merely heavy environments, he's just going to shine. And he's just going to be like an unconquerable bully at times. Like a lot of people are taking Skarbrand at the moment, who's essentially like the demon version of, well, the full demon version of Angron, probably a little bit less killy, but possibly a little bit more in some ways. And yeah, he's finding great purchase in a lot of the demon lists at the moment because it's a very melee-centric environment out there in the kind of match play games. So yeah, I legitimately, like, name a fast melee army that has come out and not been good, you know? The question is, how fast can World Eaters be? If they're Drakari level, Harlequins level, please don't be. They're going to be insanely powerful. And even if they're not, even if they're like Sisters level, they're still going to be extremely good. Bloody Rose Sisters is kind of the equivalent that I want them to come around of, because it's kind of well balanced. It's a bit of a skew list, which we know World Eaters is kind of innately going to be. But it's pretty fair. I mean, like Sisters is a pretty fair army. They tend to just kind of out trade people by having a density of pieces of aggressive units. And I'd love to see World Eaters be something similar.
Yeah, some of these models look like they have long legs. They might be fast.
I just want Karn to be good. I feel like
a good guy or like
no
good stats.
No. No. I feel like all of my World Eaters friends, like, they try to bring Karn, but like it always seems like some shenanigan or other happens and he just never gets into combat. And I just want him to be able to get into combat more regularly.
If Karn could be in a land raider that Angron throws at people.
Yes, please.
I might have to get this army. I think it is going to be, it's a difficult kind of road to how do you make a balanced assault army that can make it into combat sometimes and do what it's supposed to do and does not just get automatically picked up by shooting in turn one. And Blood Angels are pretty much there, so it's not like they don't kind of have a good idea of kind of what functions.
Wonder, like, does anybody know why Berserkers just don't have jump packs? Like, have Berserkers ever had the option to take a jump pack?
Berserkers, no. You know, a Khorne Chaos Lord? Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and Raptors, in previous editions, I mean, Raptors have been great things to add in. I mean, especially when you consider the 9-inch move that World Eaters have had built in for the last, I'd say, 2 CSM editions. It's been pretty good. And so, like, yeah, jump packs totally. Jump packs and bikes, right? Bikes were a big thing with the Demonkin, right? Demonkin of Khorn. Bikes were a thing. So.
Man, that was a hell of a book.
Yeah, it was.
Fingers crossed they actually copied. That's the mechanic I want. Like, do you guys remember that? How that used to... Do you guys remember how that used to work?
Which regard?
So mid 7th edition, a codex came out called Khorne Demonkin and used to essentially accrue blood tithe points for the amount of units that died in the game. And, you know, you could use these things to summon... Well, essentially, Khorne Demonkin was letting you take demons and Chaos Space Marines as one army. So I think similar to... Disciples of Bellicor, kind of is the 9th edition... comparison, but or Yanari essentially. But this was actually a really unique thing in 7th edition. No, I don't think they'd ever done something like that before. And what it did was so amazingly thematic. It's like every like 8th thing that died, you could just kind of summon a new unit. Like, oh cool, here's 5 flesh hounds who just get deep struck in, you know, roll your deep strike dice or whatever. You could also, you know, essentially it's actually very similar to a lot of the resource mechanics we have in the game at the moment. First one that comes to mind right now being the Chaos Demons one with the Winds of the Warp dice or Laughing God dice. Hell, it's actually really comparable to a lot of those resource mechanics. Maybe I'm seeing possibly where G-Dub got the idea from, because almost all of 9th edition has a kind of internal currency to each faction, and maybe it all started with that Khorne Demon King Codex.
I mean, they do talk about it. You know, how's this Reborn in Blood work? Well, you got to come back and see. It's got to be some kind of like points or charts or something, right?
Something.
I mean, I would imagine it's similar, but you know, again, we shall see. I like how you refer to that though as the currency of the codex.
Oh, and of course, Khorne's currency is blood.
Or skulls. You can probably get away with skulls too.
Is there a market for the brass?
No.
I think that's just like gilding. That just kind of comes with it.
That just looks cool.
That's actually your penance for serving the Chaos Pantheon, is you have to paint a lot of trim.
Why do you think I don't play Chaos Space Marines anymore?
Oh,
just could not do the trim.
Man, let me tell you, I still carry around a bit of a burden that I've I painted Helldrakes and Mauler Fiends and stuff to match what was my Nurgle army at the time, Death Guard army at the time. And now Death Guard can't take that stuff. And I've also changed the color scheme of my Death Guard army. So if they came back, they'd still have to be repainted.
Nah, just play it. Just play it the way it is. You're like, this is my Slaanesh army. Well, that kind of looks a little nurgly, is it? No, it's not.
Maybe that's a good hobby segment one day, you know, efficient trim painting recipes. I know people who swear by markers.
Yeah, the sharpies. Yeah.
I'm not sure I'm quite there yet personally. That might be a Rubicon for myself. But, you know, if it works for you, all the power to you.
No, you just got to do it. And nothing says you have to do it all at one time. You know, you could do an arm, a knight or something, come back, you know. Don't have to wear yourself out about it. That's the thing. Some of this stuff can be a chore, but it doesn't have to be. And take it at your own pace.
I think if I were to go back and do another Helldrake, it's not going to happen, but we'll just say if. I think that I would do... I did it this way before. I would do all of the trim, and then I would paint the sort of panels on the inside. But if I was going to do it again, I think I would use acrylic ink instead of paint. because then it would just sort of like flow into the tiny little areas that it had to flow into. I think it'd be less work.
Yeah, so I'm of the opinion that if I ever did it, I'd actually paint the trim first. Like the trim becomes the base. Like whatever my rattle can is, that's the trim color. And then I base coat over that with just haphazardly. And then I fill
that
in.
That is one way to
like
do it.
Tanya said. Yeah. Because it's one of those things that's really fiddly. And like Tanya said, there's another of those things you can just, if you want, you can just fill it up with paint. It's literally a little well. You can just fill it up with paint if you want.
Yeah, see, I did it and I used like actual paint and it took a long time, I'm not going to lie. But I just feel like if I used like an opaque acrylic ink, I just feel like it'd take no time at all. I'd be like immediately done.
I legitimately love all the textures on Angron. That's what I was maybe trying to say before, is that where do you even start with the painting? And because, you know, without seeing the model in my hand, where do you even begin? And I don't, maybe you do base coat the flesh first to kind of give you some ideas about where the rest of the stuff has to take shape.
I tend to, because I struggle with metallics, so I tend to do all of my metallics first.
Okay.
I think that's what I do. I think I would prime it black and then I would do all of the metallics first, because it's like one of the only things that I actually dry brush, and I'm really messy at dry brushing. So yeah, black metallic base coat, wash and dry brush, like both colors, if I was going to do the brass and the silver, and then I would do the skin.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe blocking in metals. If you're a long time listener in the show, that's like my least favorite hobby activity.
Well, do you actually like, so when I base coat, I'm going to like air quote base coat metals, I just dry brush them, but like heavy.
No, like a wet dry brush. I mean, I forget what it's called. There is some kind of technique where it's called overbrushing or something like that.
I have no idea. I'm not like an actual painter. This is just how I would do it to save time. But yeah, it would just be like a heavier dry brush. So instead of taking like almost all of the paint off, you just take the paint off so that it's not kind of like wet and gloopy at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then I would just dry brush all of it.
Yeah, it's a good idea. I mean, look, at some point I'll try anything, but we'll say just blocking in the metals before, because sometimes it looks, you know, like hot garbage until you get a wash on it. So you're going to have to like...
Sometimes, like every time.
Convince yourself that you're on the right track. And that may be even more important to do with a model like this, because you're not getting this model without wanting it to look good. And then how do you even get it from the box to assembled, to primed, to the table, you know, painted to the table, and have confidence along the way? And yes, it's no easy feat. So, I mean, really, there's no wrong way to do it. Anybody that does it, got my admiration.
I think that the best way is to have your mantra at the front of your mind. Just say, trust the process, and just keep going until it looks good.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, and then don't like the box art. You just don't have to like the box. Yeah, but I do love all the weathering and stuff they've done on the metals here. You can definitely, again, all the textures and stuff on this model are amazing.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing the how-tos from Whammer on YouTube.
Those big chunky wings.
The wings are a really interesting, and I think we've talked about this before, but departure from other bloodthirster wings. Like, these have more definition in certain areas. I mean, not only, they're literally like more muscular than the average bloodthirster wings compared to, you know, it's an interesting comparison to Scarbrand's non-wings or Bellicor's wings. And so I'm really interested to see how that ends up looking like in front of me as I try to paint them and that aspect to it. Because I do think that it helps set him, Angron specifically, apart slightly from all the other bloodthirster-like variants that we've gone through.
So I saw his wings. I've got an old thirster. I've got a thirster, not from the current one, the one from, geez, like 7 years ago,
like
8 years
metal
ago.
One?
Yeah, I've got an old metal one with the bull's head. It looks like it could almost be a Beastman model for all intents and purposes.
Yeah, yeah.
Those wings kind of look like a new version of those, but evolved a different, another level again. So maybe it's both a callback and, you know, pushing the envelope.
I wouldn't be surprised. You're probably exactly right. You've nailed part of the inspiration.
Because he's very old. He's very old, you know, 10,000 years and counting on this old lad.
Looks pretty spry. So, you know, spring a step.
uh, it's interesting we don't have a dex. We don't have a dexterity stat in 40K. I wonder what Angrons would be compared to other Primarchs. Because, like, so in the fluff, I used to always think that Angron was one of the largest physically one of the largest Primarchs, because that's kind of how he's portrayed. You always read the novels in, like, larger than life, imposing, intimidating. But I've been told by some, you know, worldly aficionados, he wasn't one of the physically larger Primarchs. He was one of the more diminutive, but still considered one of the best fighters.
I mean, only probably due to his, like, unbridled ferocity. Like, I don't think it's...
I don't think he wore the bulkiest armor either, like, compared to...
Yeah, yeah, he definitely wasn't... Well, he's never been in Terminator armor, for what I can tell. But, because I complained to one of my mates who plays World Eaters, and I said, why... Because I thought his model... Because he was one of the first Primarchs. I'm like, he's a bit small. You know, he's a bit small for a Primarch model compared to the others. And he's like, nah, he's actually kind of about the same. He's really hunched over, the model is. And, He wasn't one of the biggest anyway. It was like the biggest was, Magnus, and then Vulcan were the two largest physically. I'm speaking out of armor. Please forgive me if I'm wrong. This is just me and my hobby mates chatting. I don't know anything for sure.
Yeah, that's right. Go ahead and just start with an apology. It's okay.
Yeah. That's the only way I know how to go, man.
Hey, I'm just talking here about, you know, about naked Primarchs. I'm just bringing it up.
It's good to be back, everybody.
That's right. I missed you, mate.
Hey, you guys are supposed to hate each other.
I know.
Oh, that's we'll get back I in don't. Character.
Yeah.
My immersion.
I don't know that I knew that, but it sounds right. It sounds like a fact.
I mean, it's as you know, without going too far into it. I mean, some of the books, it's pretty clear that, you know, Angron was pitied for his position, right? He was the only one that didn't really conquer his planet to be, you know, enslaved. And then he didn't really want to be rescued either. And
yeah,
his legion, like, struggled to really, like, how they adapted to reconfigure going from being the warhounds to the world eaters, and how they had to kind of figure out a way to, like, get him to join the team. It was a very interesting dynamic and development as a character. And then how he progressed. I mean, some of the things and how he came to be a demon Primarch. It's really hard. I don't have the timeline in my mind right away if he was the first demon Primarch necessarily. I don't think he was, given some of the other things, without ruining too much of the story. But I do think he definitely tapped into it. And they did a really good job of fleshing him out in his development. But bringing him all the way forward to now, you know, I don't think that being a demon prince, he has to be held down by any of those past factors. So it doesn't have to be that way. But I'll be very interested to see how it compares to a certain degree amongst the others.
Has anybody done a deep dive into his armor versus the Forge World model from the Heresy?
So yeah, I mean, I definitely, that's what drew me into the model when it was first previewed, you know, even when it was leaked, trying to look at some of the armor. Some of it's there. Some of the plates apply directly to it. I have an Angron model, and then I have a Kitbash. I've used a second Angron model for some other things. And so I'm a fan of the armor and the direction they took it. They probably could have, and I think I said this when we first talked about this in the leaks of Angron, they probably could have done a little more to certain regards, because his armor actually goes from being relatively elaborate from 30K, and then it gets reduced down. And I was actually really interested to see the change. We know from the World Eater Codex and the other things that, you know, Karn has one of the axes, right? And then there was the other one, which is actually a relic that can be taken by a World Eater's character. And so Gorefather and Gorechild are out there. And so I was really interested to see the new weapons and their names in the released, you know, community site page that they had for the rules of Spine Grinder, the new axe. And then the sword has what looks like a demon name that I couldn't rightly say by myself.
Samniarinus. Right.
There you go. You got it. Whatever you just said. It was cool to see. It was cool to see nonetheless.
I'm surprised it's not called, like, Sanguinius Sucks.
I mean, that's probably what it means.
It probably is demon for...
Screw you.
Yeah, I'm the Red Angel. Said just that way, by the way.
Yeah, just that way.
I'm glad you brought the weapons. The bloodletting sweep, you talk about it, you know, it's not just 12 attacks. And how does he get to that guardsman 36? count or whatever is that each time an attack is made with his weapon, the profile makes 3 hit rolls instead of 1 at neg 3 AP, 1 damage.
Get it.
It's just not enough, right?
Sure.
And then skull-taking slash is strength plus 5, neg 4 AP, D3 plus 3 damage. Yeah, that'll kill some stuff. I mean, so the perception in a lot of the comments so far is that, well, I guess if Angron just gets in combat with anything, he just kills it.
I mean, kind of rightly so, yeah?
I'm not judging. You know? I think, yeah. I mean, why wouldn't he kill everything he gets in combat with?
So I was wondering, he's probably going to bracket at 18 wounds, right?
Well, yes.
Every model over 9 wounds has bracketed, yeah?
Yes.
Yeah.
So okay. Maybe that's why it starts out as like an absolute ridiculous amount of attacks.
Well, some characters get the attacks go up when they get wounded.
Scarbrand goes up.
Oh, no.
Yeah, does Gazgul go up? I think Gazgul goes up as well.
He does.
Yeah. He should just like double. Goes from 12 to 24, 24 to 48 on lowest bracket.
Got 2 wounds left, baby. Look out. I mean,
he will already kill everything he touches. So does it matter at that point? Like, when the cup is full, the cup, you know, cup overflowing doesn't mean much.
I kind of love that, though. Can you imagine just how fast he would be moving? Like, I mean, demonic, preternaturally, the fastest thing we've ever seen in our mind's eye in Warhammer 40,000.
It'd be more believable if he had 2 extra arms. Just saying.
Dang.
or if his arms moved like General Grievous.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah.
And look, we don't know that's the case. We're just talking completely speculative and out of our behinds right now. But it does.
We're just making up nonsense, really.
Well, right. Speculative because... Yeah, because it also says in the picture there, Angron with 10 plus wounds remaining has these stats, you know, so you have to assume he has different stats when he has less than 10.
It's just, is it more or is it less?
Has anyone read anything to the effect of whose bionic skull, bionic-eyed skull that is around is Gorget? Is that who we think it is?
That's a lot. I think it's just speculation. I think that there's a good skull to bionically enhanced skull ratio that you find in most Warhammer 40,000 models.
It's true. It's true.
There are a number of commissars that have bionic laser eyeballs. So just say.
I've often wondered, and I'm looking at this model right now, and just putting it out there, G-Dub, I'd love it if there was a bit of differentiation between the size of skulls. Like, because right now it just looks like he's only killed regular humans. From the size of skulls, because there's nothing to differentiate like a superhuman or an abhuman. Like, there's nothing to differentiate. Like,
that's a telling fact about all our bones are very similar on the inside.
No, but you know, a Space Marine's head should be
they have normal size heads. Primaris Space Marines have the same head as Firstborn Marines,
but they're bigger than regular humans.
Have you put a Canadian head next to a? It's like Altered Beast, the video game. Is it the head stay the same size?
Did it?
Oh my yeah.
God. I'm joking.
I'm making stuff up. Not the Altered Beast thing. That is definitely true. The head stayed the 100%, same size.
100%. Yeah, 100%. I would love to see some bigger and smaller. I would like to see some head variety. Like, you know, you remember that packet of heads that they did, the 300 heads on a sprue? That had a bunch of different sized heads. And I've ever since that came out, I've been, every time I remember... It's like the first time in the year since that thing came out, but then I haven't noticed a head differentiation, and I've been looking for it. I look for it. Like, can I see any obvious orc heads? Can I see any obvious, you know, Space Marine to human scale heads? Can I see any Bulgren Ogryn heads? Can I see any Eldar heads?
They used to, though, right? Like, the Chaos Space Marine Terminators, didn't their trophy rack have different...
Yeah, Abaddon, too, back in the day. Yeah.
And just looking at Angron, I can't see any differences. There could be, and I just can't tell.
Well, from the photo. I think that in some cases, these, you know, like, what's his name? Kurz, you know, that has those heads on his armor, like, just stuck to his armor.
Mm.
I don't actually think those are random. I think those are people of importance to Kurz.
Well, that's kind of what I was alluding to with Angron. You're telling me that Angron only prizes regular human heads? I'd assume all the ones he's got are at minimum Space Marine heads.
Those are probably, like, Old World Leader Psyker skulls.
The whole librarius of the world leaders. That's amazing.
I mean, I don't know that. Seems like a good story.
It's canon now, y'all.
There's that part in one of the books to where you get to, like, I reread that chapter like three times because I was like, what on earth is happening? This is seems awkward, but they're talking about World Eater Psykers. Like, oh, hey, getting spicy. And, you know, no spoilers, but you don't see any of those around now. That's all I'm saying. Or do you?
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah. All right, well, let's take a quick break, then we'll come back. Thanks for listening to us kind of jaunt on about this stuff. We'll see you in a second.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games, Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey, everybody, we are back. Still got the whole crew here. You know, again, just kind of getting the drips and drops of the World Eaters kind of transition, talking about, you know, the little bit of stuff we know and can speculate about the eight bound.
I mean, why have one bound demon inside of you when you could have eight?
I just love the idea of, like, whatever passes for a, you know, master of possession or apothecary right now with the World Eaters, just slapping a berserker on the back. And you know that meme, you slap the hood of the car and say you can fit so many.
You can fit so many corn demons in this baby.
Because the whole premise is they're Zerkers with like eight demons in them, yeah?
Yeah. I think that's this is kind of like their equivalent of their possessed.
Yeah, well, and it's honestly an interesting combination between possessed. It really takes it to the next level. It's almost like, you know, the obliterators are the techno virus, and it's taken some, you assume, a chaos marine and turned them into this monstrous thing. And this is really like the Khorne 8 close combat version, but they took a Khorne berserker and did it.
I do really enjoy the idea of having a buzzsaw in a literal clawed hand. It's so extra. It is so Warhammer.
No, I mean, they really did. They took the, and this is kind of what I was talking about before too, in some of the previous shows where we were comparing the Khorne 8 aesthetic right now to the Death Guard or the Thousand Sons. Like, they definitely have their own signature aesthetic, right? Like Nurgle, Plague Marines, and how some of them have grown into it. And I was really hoping that we were going to get to that. And I think that the Eightbound deliver in that direction. They do take it to that next level. I mean, the Khorne Berserkers are definitely Khorne Berserkers, but they also share a lot with Chaos Space Marine aesthetic in general, right? The gothic kind of curved trimming. They've got a couple extra skulls and Khorne symbols on them.
I love the shoulder pads from the older Khorne Berserkers too. I guess current Khorne Berserkers, you know, the kind that almost look like a, you know, completely embossed Khorne symbol all over the whole shoulder that kind of extends lower than a normal Space Marine shoulder.
Exactly. Yep. And that's a great one. That's a great example. And then they've really tied that in with these new Khorne Berserkers. And then you take the eightfold and they are, it's not just possessed. It's not, it's not just the new version of the Mutilator compared to the Obliterator's chassis or model build or however you want to fall back on that kind of infrastructure. It definitely is its own thing, and it's very Khorne 8. There's teeth and blades and claws and everything that looks like brutal melee just coming off of every corner of this model. It definitely fulfills the aesthetic, and I think they'll look really good next to a Angron, for example. I do wish, and if I had to be nitpicky on anything else, I do wish that, you know, eight bound, that there was a way to take them in a unit of eight, or at least like four, so that I could have two and make eight that way or something like that. But I get it. I understand. I'll go back to my corner and my war of numbers and whatnot. I get it. I'm sorry.
I like that they kind of have nods back to the Hellbrute as well. Like, they have all the piping and stuff that has the fleshy bits kind of covering it. And so it, like, they kind of feel like infantry, but they also kind of feel like a demon engine. It's kind of neat.
Yeah, for sure.
With, you know, we're going off of what we saw in the preview and then a little bit of what they said in the preview. But can we then speculate that, like possessed and some of these other things, there's like support characters that are going to help buff these things or enhance them to be more about what we visually expect them to be able to be capable of?
If there's one thing we know for sure, is that they will have a bunch of minuscule buffing elite characters, because that's pretty much every, like, all Chaos Space Marines have a slew of this guy buffs this way, this guy buffs this way. What I don't know is whether they're going to get, like, you know how, so Death Guard don't have a chaplain, which is interesting, but T-Suns do in the Infernal Master, and of course you've got the Dark Disciples for regular Chaos Space Marines. I'm really interested to see what they get and what they don't, because there are some things that Death Guard have that no one else has, like the Foul Blightspawns, etc., etc., their own, you know, special apothecaries and stuff. So there is kind of a bunch of different ways G-Dub could go with it. They could get, like, five freaking elite slot characters that all buff in one special, unique, spicy way, or they could get none of that. You got to assume they get something like some of them surely are ubiquitous. Like a Master of Executions has to be kind of like ubiquitous for Welders. I mean, Welders don't get that. Who deserves to have that from Chaos Space Marines? And I really want to see, well, you're seeing a lot more Possessed and, you know, Eightbound-esque units. So I really want to see them get a Master of Possession as well. But then that's a Psyker, so they can't. So I really hope that they at least get a Chaplain equivalent, because because of course they can't have Psykers, so they got to have a Chappy, right?
Are there any, like, throwback things from the, like, specialty units from the Horus Heresy that we can look to?
Well, like, of course, I mean, they're two special units from the Horus Heresy were the Zerkers and the Red Butchers, right? Which they kind of already got already. So are you talking, like, did they have any special army composition traits or army composition?
Yeah, or like traits? A console that was more in line with the World Eater philosophy than any others or whatever.
Probably a Warmonger console. Like, I mean, that's the one that comes to the mind first of the console options in 30K.
I mean, maybe we shouldn't speculate too much. Again, I know this is just like it's a cool Legion, a lot of fans of the Legion out there, so it's fun to kind of see how close we can get.
Yeah, so it was the Rampages, apologies. It wasn't the Zerkers back in the day. It was the Rampages, which of course became the Zerkers. I'd love to see them get, like, their own Hellbrutes, like double fist Hellbrutes or double claw, double melee weapon Hellbrutes that are just kind of extra fast or something spicy. Like, what do you do with a Zerker and a Red Butcher when they can still fight but got no legs no more? Like Lieutenant Dan, you chuck him in a freaking Dreadnought.
Throw them right in there.
Yeah.
We'll see. Well, I guess, yeah. I mean, again, fun to speculate. Don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole and that kind of stuff. But we did, you know, let's talk about how getting this Astra Militarum ready to go, tabletop ready. And one of the coolest things about the big old flat surfaces of the tanks is to maybe decorate them to make them look kind of cool. I mean, beyond making them just look kind of cool. So quick, like, how I paint tanks has evolved over the years. And I'm not huge on sub-assemblies all the time, but one of the things that I've always gone to do now is painting the tracks separate.
Oh.
Yeah.
Really?
And then gluing them on after the fact.
I'm going to take a big old skip on that.
I'll weather them up at the same time, like after they're already on, but I like to get the chassis of the tank pretty close to painted and then paint, base coat, you know, dry brush, do some detailing on the tracks, washing them before I put them on the vehicle now. That's me. Tim, you don't agree? Now, look, I'm not claiming to be a great painter either. I've figured I've basically kind of backed in to a lot of good looking models.
I think, like, most of how I paint, especially my guard army, it's like based off of the fact that I really struggle with metallics, so I always just do my metallics over black primer first, like, no matter what it is, and then I'll paint everything else around it. And that's just me, like, acknowledging that this is the weakest part of my painting, so that's how I kind of get around it.
Oh, fair enough. Well, why do you say that, though?
That the metallics are my weakest part?
Yeah.
I think because I don't know how to get much depth out of them without dry brushing. So I'm like a layer painter. I don't really dry brush much of anything. There's very few exceptions, but metallics are like the one thing that I always dry brush because I just don't know how to layer paint them and make them look like a true metallic.
I also struggled to, like, to get any of the heavy metal type style of, like, well, they make it look simple. Well, just paint it and then do some Stormhold Silver and, like, your world is rosy. Like, I cannot do that.
Yeah, I don't know. And then I think another reason why I struggle is just the nature of metallic paints, right? Because the medium is different in most metallic paints, right? It's a very transparent medium. And sometimes with some paints, it's really hard to get a nice sort of even, like, no brushstroke look on the metallics. And the only way I've really figured out how to do that for myself is by dry brushing on even the base coat of the metallic. So that's just why I do it that way.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah. With that, again, with the Trax paint, sometimes I paint the Trax black. And again, I got a different way, but I just like, I think that trying to go back and paint in the individual Trax and not get paint on the hull of the armor is a time sink for me. And that's why I do it the other way.
Yeah. I think if I dry brushed the tank itself, then I probably would do it your way, but I don't. So this way actually saves me time.
Yeah, fair enough. And I've gotten into over the years, talk about the evolution of painting the tank is I use Dark Angel Green. Caliban Green is my base coat. It's like the very base, like of the tank itself. And then I build up colors till I get to that Jungle Green, Strachan Green. I can't remember exactly which green. I have to go look at my recipe book. But that top, you know, highlight color to catch all the rivets and stuff is that Strachan Green.
Mm-hmm. See, and one of those greens. And like, I'm just that crazy person that individually paints and then washes each rivet.
Sometimes I do. If I feel like it's lacking the definition, I will go back in. But most of my tanks, you know, I'm getting tanks to match in like a 20-year-old paint job, which is, you know, I shouldn't say 20 at this point because I've repainted some at this point to get up to where it is. But after I've gotten that nice base coat on the tank, that's when I start going in with camouflage. And this would be interesting. Do you paint camouflage on tanks and stuff?
I do on my Chimeras. Yeah.
Is that a theme choice?
Yeah. So my artillery Chimera sort of bases, those are all green. And then my Hellhounds and other fast attacks, so like my Sentinels and stuff, are black. And then my Lehman Russ battle tanks are gray. And I just sort of wanted something that incorporated all of those colors onto my Chimeras. So I took all of those. Oh, and my accent color is like a lighter shade of green than my artillery pieces. So I wanted to incorporate all of those colors onto the Chimera. So I did that with camouflage.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so I start with a base coat of the gray of the Lehman Russes, and then I don't really know how I would describe my camouflage. It's not like tiger stripes, but it's not like digital camo. It's just kind of interesting. I guess I kind of am inspired by zebra stripes a little bit, but so I start with the gray and then I block in the green areas and then I put like a little sort of irregular thin line around sort of the inside of the green areas, and then the inside I sort of paint black. So it's kind of like spots where it goes like black, light green, dark green.
And with my camo, a little bit more traditional colors of, because and it's like the Cadian color scheme too, from all the pictures you see and that kind of stuff. Well, I should say, I don't know if it's the exact color scheme, but it's mimicked that color scheme. And just get a big old, like, large brush or a large dry brush. Get a fair amount of the Zandri dust.
One of my favorites.
It's like the darker of the light tan colors.
It covers so nicely. It's one of my favorite paints. Yeah.
And just go nuts in whatever pattern that I want. And I don't even, I'm not saying it's not sloppy, but I'm not, at this point in time, I'm just kind of sketching out a pattern with the brush in a way that makes sense to me. This is not true camouflage. I'm sure you'd pick it out of any forest. It's just going to hide it.
Yeah. The same with my camouflage. It's not actually true camouflage. It works with like the headcanon of my army. And I do find that if it's more irregular, it usually looks better.
Yeah. And the point being is like, where you can care about the hyperrealism and you can look at like what camouflage is scientifically designed, you know, refute that, Red, if you need to, if I'm wrong. But when you're sitting down to paint your models, you don't have to necessarily care about that.
The way that I look at it is, like, we don't know what kind of camouflage would actually work best on alien planets.
Keep going.
So that's my headcanon, right? Because there's also different types of camouflage that exist in this world, right? And they all sort of use different sort of principles on how they work. Right, like dazzle camo, it works kind of like zebras or whatever, right?
Sure. No, I mean, don't get me wrong. Like, there's no sense. You have to, and we've talked about this before, right? You have to suspend your disbelief one way or the other when it comes down to it. It's okay. Like, I really think that there is some awesome stuff to people trying different levels of accuracy with things. You know, when you look at historical stuff, you have something to work off of as far as what people tried, whether it worked, what people actually tried, whether it worked or not is a whole other thing. For this, and we go into whole sci-fi land thing, you know, you see some of those really great paint jobs where folks have like the shift, right? Like take like, what were they? Eliminators, the Phobos snipers for Primaris Marines, mm-hmm. where like the camo cloaks they have are like a certain color. And then at a certain point, there's like a shift line where it changes to match the terrain or something like that, right? And you're right, Tanya, that you don't know how aliens see stuff. We also don't know if the paint that the Astra Militarum are using or whatever, like automatically provides some kind of camouflage. You don't know if it actually like masks heat signatures. You don't know if it does whatever. You could literally make up whatever and roll out with it. And it's okay. And as long as you enjoy it and you feel like you're pushing towards something, I think it's great. I love that to see how people try to apply it in different ways. And I honestly, outside of my like everyone should wear helmets in combat kind of thing, I can let the different paint jobs go, because again, you have bright red Marines or bright green Marines or straight up just everybody wearing yellow, as disgusting as that approach is. And like, what are you gonna do? You can't, like, at that point, like they've just foregone the whole idea of it. And for some of this, in a lot of ways that the Astra Militarum works, like, you're only going to get so far with camo anyways. The Space Marines actually get away with it easier because they work in smaller units in a lot of cases until they're wearing like bright yellow.
It's like they don't actually wear camo. They just like magically blend into their surroundings.
Sure. Right. And so like there's all sorts of stuff to it, because you imagine like a lot of armies now, contemporary in the real world, they actually change their camo depending on where they go. And so you would think that you've got the time, or relatively, if you're not being pushed through whatever, you know, blender that is the 40K war machine, but you're actually going to do that and paint your vehicles to be or match the environment, or people change their gear or what have you.
Or you've got a cool display board that you want your army to look cool on.
Exactly. Right. I mean, of course. And that's, I don't think anybody should feel the need to hold it against anybody else for camo when it comes to the models and everything. I just appreciate people trying to do it in a different way, or, you know, to make it happen in those different aspects, because I think it's really cool.
That's a long way of explaining that my ridiculous approach to camouflage is cool. So thanks for that.
You're welcome.
But it takes this large brush with the Xandri dust on there. And I know I just kind of, I've got my model that's most of the way painted. And let me tell you, anybody out there right now, like, one of the gut checks, the hardest thing to do is putting some weathering or extra stuff or this camouflage in this instance on a model that already looks good.
Oh, the first time that I painted camouflage, I was like, oh, this gray base coat is perfect. I don't know if I could do this.
Yeah, or man, I got the dry brush on these rivets. Perfect. Never gonna be any better. And I'm about to cover it up with this. I can't bring myself to this. You can. You can do it.
You can always paint each individual rivet after the fact and be a mad person like myself.
So with kind of sketch out where you want the pattern to be. And, you know, if anything, I do kind of counsel about following maybe some convention is go completely across the armor plate, or have it kind of bend back onto itself in some, you know, like irregular, like big old U shape or something or whatever, you know, have it be bold with it is what I'm kind of counseling here. And you don't have to be perfect with it right now, because you can go back and tidy up some of those areas that you may not like to fill in gaps or whatever with a similar process with a more precise hand after you've gotten the sketch on there about where you wanted to go. The big old splotches of this other color is what I'm saying.
Yeah, and I really do stand by the point that like you don't really want it to look like regular, right? So you might want to have like some of those splotches a lot bigger than others, or maybe they're like skinny and some are fat or something like that. Like the variation is gonna look a lot better, because I tried doing them where it kind of looked the same and I was like, this doesn't look like camouflage at all.
Yeah, I mean, look at some of the examples on the GW site, or even look at examples of tanks in the real world, but like just use those as examples. Don't feel like you have to be replicating that exactly. Then once I get that on there and then tidied up a bit, and when I say tidied up is that sometimes since you have kind of stippled or you know, just kind of put big splotches on in that area, it may look fuzzier on the thing. You may not like the way this curved a bit. You might want to clean it up a little bit, use the Zandrios to do that. That is oftentimes when I will go back and start addressing like the individual rivets like you're talking about, because I start to, you know, panel line some of the whole tank to kind of unify the areas all together. And then I will often at that point in time go back and dry brush most of the tank with a lighter bone color, in the same way that I would highlight like an orc's flesh or something like that.
So I'm curious, Red, do you paint camouflage on your tanks?
Nope.
No? Just like one color?
Yeah, so I mean, like with my Tanith, and I think you've probably seen pictures of my tanks and a couple other things, my Manicores and Wyvern. They're just in a solid green. I just do a green that kind of applies. It's the same green that I use on the camo cloaks for my Tanith, which I think ends up blending well. And it's, again, going back to this whole thing that, you know, we have all sorts of vehicles and everything in a contemporary environment that we don't necessarily camouflage the vehicles themselves, but we come with things like camo nets and other materials that we use to camo vehicles to help them. Because again, like, you know, and Tanya, you just sent that picture that in our own personal chat so I could see it. I think you should share that because I think it looks great, because a lot of times, you know, the different ways that camo is done, it helps break the silhouette. Like when you're looking at it, sometimes it's made to do a certain way that it breaks the way the eye catches the vehicle. You're not seeing the same shapes or lines when you look at it, because the paint job is done literally to do that, to distract you from being able to do that. And so there's some of those aspects to that, which I think is great. And I think that your paint job helps do that to a certain degree, right? And then like mine, with my solid colors, it's more to help blend it in certain ways and also be recognizable. I think when you go back to, like I was joking about with the Space Marines being so blatantly not camouflaged in a lot of cases, they still have like color markings and things like that that set them apart from a distance, that like the Ultramarines are all wearing this like deep, vibrant blue color. But then, you know, per the Codex prior to Gilliman coming in and whatnot, the trim on their shoulder pads were different colors to indicate that they were from different companies. And it'd be like bright yellow or bright red or something like that. And so some of it, you just kind of accept that it is what it is and that you need to accomplish different things with the coloring. My tanks, for example, by squadron, they have different colors on the bore evacuators, which is the kind of the larger part on the battle cannon. And so I do that because it's a signal or a signifying thing that when someone were to look at the vehicle, they could tell it apart from others and understand which unit or associated part of the squadron or what have you that it is. When it comes down to me and my painted all in the same color, you know, and Paul, you brought up some really good points using like Zandri dust to help highlight it and different things you can go with. I mean, I admit that I've taken an easy way out by using contrast. Contrast does a really good job of catching a lot of those highlights, as well as sinking into the recesses of the vehicle. And then following up with like a Thonian camo shade, for example, really just takes it to that next depth. But that's really how I've approached it, a lot of mine. And I think that it does just fine, right? It gives still that military uniform look, and it does have aspects of camouflage just associated with it.
I want you to make little camo nets for all your tanks now.
So I actually, a good friend of mine showed me exactly how to do it, and I would love to do it. Given some more time and focus to be able to go through it, using you can use like netting, or not just netting,
it's
but
like some gauze and like gauze, pull it apart.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Medical gauze. I've seen some folks like use the as kind of the supporting piece of that, using like screens, you know, like window screens, to because it's a little more
like rigid. Stiffer. You can bend it.
Yes.
And,
exactly. Exactly.
I'm sensing a future hobby segment.
Sure.
No, I haven't done this, but I've seen people like use white glue to form it to the shape that they want, and then pull it off and have it be modular and like the
sure. You know, and you can also, you know, there's several hobby sites that you can get leaves, like pattern leaves, and you can put the leaves, you can just glue them to the screening and the medical gauze once you've stiffened it out. And it looks really good. I mean, it's really fantastic. It can be done easily. When you're doing a display board kind of deal, what people don't, you know, you don't see it that often, but we have camo nets that are stood up and that go over, like when our vehicles are stationary for a certain period of time, you put these camo nets over it, and it kind of helps break up. You can't see it from above. It's harder to really make out from a distance and that kind of deal. And of course, it's supposed to blend in with the environment and whatnot. So you could have a vehicle that was completely painted off color, and then you just have this camo net set up around it to a certain degree, almost like a blind, right? Like with hunting or something like that. And it can look very cool in an environment like that when you set it up, for sure.
You know, you said that you could buy like tiny little leaves. I've also seen like leaf shaped hole punches.
Yeah, there you go.
And then you can actually like punch it out of real leaves.
Oh, sure. I mean, I think it might actually break up, but just because, you know, the fragility of the leaves, I don't disagree. You could. But I do see where like you could use construction paper or different other kinds of paper that you could probably use those. That leaf hole puncher thing is a great idea. I've seen that used before, too.
On my changing gears just a little bit, but on the like miniatures, like Catechin models themselves, I'll paint camo in their fatigues, and it's a little bit different of a process, but you can do it largely with kind of irregular shaped dots or splotches. I try to put a little bit more variation in color and include blacks and browns and then the tan color on those, just for a little bit more contrast. But since, you know, not everybody's getting that up close and personal with your miniatures, you can be a little bit less precise, but it gives you that really good look from 2-3 feet away, just with a few dots every now and then. Camo is
I don't know if I would have enough patience to do that on all of my infantry.
He's got to want it.
Right. Well, that's the thing. Like, I mean, you see soldiers in the more contemporary environment having like branches and stuff stuck into their gear, or, you know, leaves or foliage or whatnot, like tied into their gear. And yeah, that's definitely something that could be a very time consuming, but ultimately I think a rewarding thing to do for your models. If anybody ever got to that point, it'd be very cool.
Make no mistake, I did not do like all the guardsmen at one time. This is over a year's type thing. And, you know, let's not forget that I often use the night or two before a tournament as an excuse to go back and revisit 5-10 models or something.
If I'm going to go through like all of the love and attention and work to go ahead and like paint camouflage on all of my guardsmen and like maybe fashion little branches and stuff over them, like my opponent better be giving me like the benefits of dense cover for my infantry at all times.
There you go. Maybe that could be a new faction stat. So. well, look, that's our show this week. I know we jumped, you know, from like two ends of the spectrum of how many guardsmen can Angron kill in one combat sequence to how much time you could spend painting your guardsmen's pants. Yeah. But I think we covered the spectrum on this episode.
I feel like all of the segments were just so fitting for us having Red back.
We do what we can. Do a little.
I appreciate it.
Little fan and cast service here. Look, coming up to the end of the year, going to try to get as many shows out as we possibly can. Please be patient with us as trying to get, you know, adjusting to everyone's schedule and stuff. But they are coming, and we really appreciate everybody listening and hanging out. This is not the year-end introspective or anything like that. Got more stuff coming, but I just wanted to invite everyone to keep listening and to be patient with us as we organize all this stuff leading into the turn of those clocks. But you know, it's been a great episode. Glad everybody got to be here.
The whole family.
There we go.
So glad to be back.
Leave us some 5-star reviews, please. Like, share, and subscribe if you have not already. Maybe consider getting a shirt. The link, got a question, is like, where can I find the link? The link is actually in the show notes. I don't know where you listen to the podcast specifically, if you can see the notes, but I put it up towards the top of the post. And if you can't, then you can go to forgenarrative.net and see the show notes there. We'll see you all next week, everybody.
Bye, everybody.
See ya.
What they said, but I already subscribed. You better do it too.